I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, NPR stories from the sleepy, slow news summer of 25 years ago. Now, personally, I really like the kind of journalism this time of year inspires, like this story of three sheep in the back seat of a car.
It must have been 90 degrees by the time we reached the turnpike. I couldn't even roll down the windows for fear the sheep would leap out at 65 miles an hour.
Or how about a format breaker featuring Mike Kelly and his letters home from summer camp?
Dear Mom, last night after Lights Out, which is at 10 o'clock, Adam, Slapnick were all talking about sex. Jeff, Brad, and I just listened.
Stay tuned for the full story. And as a value-added bonus, you won't have to get out of your comfy chaise lounge to enjoy this interview with a very famous movie star who tells the story of how he was discovered.
Larry said after he finished his last movie, he goes, "You see any interesting actors lately?" And Wally said, "Yeah, I did see one actor." And she goes, "Well," he goes, "Well, who was it?" And she said it was Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner on Playback. Public radio just doesn't get much dreamier than that. Okay, we kind of missed July 4th here, but I promised you Americans talking about America, so here they are.
Only in America,
Statue of Liberty on every corner, in every color, mainly plastic.
Egg creams.
The Challenger explosion. Freedom to fail.
Only in America can you drive across the country and just see bleakness as far as you can see and then hit the mountains and then hit the sea and then just go on in infinity. Just wonderful things.
When I'm driving along in the car, I think everything is too big. Too many miles over here.
Only in America do people get drunk on 4th of July as a sport, as a national sport.
Now worship of your Lord and your God.
This is a melting pot of a different cultural background, and everything's America, from Far East cultural heritage to Middle East to European to only in America that could happen.
That I could make as much money as I am writing romance novels.
Well, I think that you are feeling like one big nation, one big family, one big American family. I think I come from Holland, and in Holland people don't feel so united as you do.
Land of opportunity. Absolutely. You bet.
The things for everybody who is coming to the United States for the first time is to find this kind of freedom, and people seem to be happy, and the way of life is completely different than what you can see somewhere else.
Only in America. Fresh air. Blue skies. Freedom.
Freedom. Straight up. Right on. Freedom to say anything you want. Here's fast-talking Ian Schulz with his take on the tabloids.
Music. Life. Style. Lifestyle. Music. All come alive with Ian Schulz, your guide to popular culture. And now, here's Ian.
There's Rock Hudson's ravaged face in the rack by the express lane. There's John Phillips' face in every talk show under the sun. There's another quotation, dripping with remorse, from Kathy Evelyn Smith. There's the repeat, I'm sorry, there's the encore presentation of the special that says Marilyn Monroe's death was covered up. Joan Crawford's coat hanger, Fatty Arbuckle's pop bottle, trivial relics, artificial artifacts, gossip and rumors, John Barrymore's cadaver propped up as a drunken prank. Who's gay? Who isn't? Who has AIDS? Who doesn't? Elvis, impersonators, wander the face of America like mediums waiting to be possessed by the spirit of a saint. When we consume these rancid tidbits of gossip and libel, we light once more the brief candle of those guttered lives. Wired tramples the memory of John Belushi and the dead horse of a sluggish prose style with the self-satisfied relish of a knight bringing down a dragon. But these people aren't dragons, merely household words like Comet or Xerox. In front of me, in the express lane, a mother with three children struggles with her purse as she tries to balance a weeping toddler and count change at the same time. She's got this week's People. She's got the Stars. She's got a large box of cornflakes. She's got generic diet soda. The Stars are meant for her, to keep the pages turning when the kids are screaming, to keep her hand off the remote control, to keep her on the couch. The Lifestyles of the Wounded Famous skim the surface of pop culture scum, tarnished coins skipping across a dead pond. The coin never sinks. We just keep spending it. The story never ends. We just keep reading it. These useless, silly books and magazines become more arguments for the disappearance of the printed word. They're worse than pornography. Pornography, at least, has an obvious function. Now, during the Middle Ages, a holiday called Feast of Fools openly mocked once a year the rituals of church and state. Today in America, every day is a holiday. We don't have rituals anymore, just photo opportunities. The feudal system is gone, but the lords and ladies of the living room have the remote control scepter that keeps a fool in cap and bells. A fool stays a fool as long as America pays attention. This is called media exposure, and every fool in America wants it, including yours truly. I leaf through the Inquirer searching for my name. Sure, when will scandal touch me? When will my name be linked with mismanners in a shocking affair of the heart? When will my unprofessional behavior cause me to be barred from the set of the Francis Ford Coppola movie? Will I ever get to smash a camera? Will I sneer at my fans? Will I turn to drugs to relieve the solitary burden of fame? When will it be my turn to be eaten in the never-ending feast of fools? I'm ready, America. I gotta go.
There are many waves in the currents of culture. Catch them with Ian Scholes. It's all rock and roll to him.
And now, for story, I'm really just too embarrassed to introduce, so I'm going to let Susan Sandberg do it.
This week, the Supreme Court ruled that states can keep their laws outlawing certain sexual practices. So now, commentator Andrei Kudrescu has a six-letter word on his mind. That word is sodomy.
Ever since the court ruling on sodomy, I've been noticing it everywhere. Ancient pottery depicts nothing but sodomy. Everybody in history used to drink from these pots. I went to the museum, nothing but sodomy on the walls. Of course, art is the work of sodomites. Anybody influenced by art is a sodomite too, I thought, as I looked up at the thousands of windows of my city. All those people in all those rooms, all alone with their art and their sodomy. City people, everyone knows, are sodomites. Sodom was a city. Books, of course, are also full of sodomy. You can barely bump into a story these days without some sodomites right smack in the middle of it. Not that the old stories are better. They are full of unresolved sodomite tension. It is better not to read, but then one might bump into folk tales and myths, which, as everyone knows, are nothing but sodomies. People in them sodomize sheep. Even in jokes, people sodomize pigs. The movies, God knows, aren't any better. The sodomites of Hollywood have managed to push their ideas into every picture you see. Even family movies are probably full of subliminal sodomy. Who knows what lies hidden in Lassie and Bambi? Clearly, history, cities, art, literature, joke-telling, and the cinema are agents of sodomy. Everyone they touch is liable to go home and practice. The Supreme Court didn't go far enough. It should have hit the plague at its roots by enjoining us from history and art. But that isn't really my concern. Americans, as everyone knows, are stubborn people. They don't like being told what not to do. I fear that sodomy will now spread. People who until now had been content with a missionary position after a hard day in church might take up sodomy out of spite. And protest groups, helped by rock and roll, which is nothing but musical sodomy, may take up the cause. Instead of hands across America.
Yeah, well, lock up your farm animals, especially your sheep. Here's Jeff O'Brien.
The county fair means sheep, specifically three sheep. Three Shropshires, which had names I can't recall, despite the fact that we were traveling companions. Maybe I'm not so good with names, but I never forget a face. They all looked like Bill Cosby. When a buddy asked if I wanted to help him and his neighbor at the State Farm Show, I jumped at the chance. Not because I had any yearning to scrub sheep, but because it meant 3 days off school. I'd have done just about anything to get out of Greasy Gus's junior civics class, even if it meant riding all the way to Harrisburg with three sheep and an old DeSoto. There were four of us, not counting the sheep, me, two chums, and Patty. The sheep were hers. We stowed our gear in the trunk and removed the back seat to make room for her babies. She called them her babies. One of us would have to ride in the back on a cement block with the sheep. We drew straws. Everyone else thought it was funny. Especially when Patty drove through town hitting every red light on Main Street, honking the horn as my pals leaned out the window, hooting and waving and pointing to the back seat. It must have been 90 degrees by the time we reached the turnpike. Wool always made me itch. I couldn't even roll down the windows for fear the sheep would leap out at 65 miles an hour, seriously lessening their chances for a master fitter's ribbon. I'd never really considered it before, but three sheep have 12 legs. They wheeled their oily flanks into me and expressed their fright in more ways than one. Cattlemen, I was sure, could smell me a mile away. I was fingering my sweaty face, searching for new eruptions, when I heard the siren. Patty had been doing 80. Driver's license and registration, please, the trooper said routinely before he looked into the back seat at Bill Cosby, Bill Cosby, Bill Cosby, and me. The sheep enjoyed this. They couldn't take their eyes off him. They stood stock still, ears twitching. The trooper returned their stares. I tried to act natural. Enjoying yourself, son? He asked. Yes, sir, I said. The rest of the trip was uneventful. Patty's babies won ribbons, and on the way home, having paid my dues, I rode shotgun. I never found out who told him. I didn't think civics could be any worse, but it was. Greasy Gus never let me forget it.
That unusual sheep story from Jeff O'Brien.
Dear Mom and Dad, today's the first day of camp. The weather is awful. They made us do our swimming test in the rain. I don't know why they made us do that. I didn't do very well.
That's 9-year-old Mike Kelly doing just what his mom asked, writing a letter home from summer camp.
My counselor's name is Chuck. He does a pretty good job doing it. He's basically nice, so the kids are nice to him. Most of the kids are getting a bad first impression of me, but I hope that will change sooner or later.
After coming into the dining room, stand at your table, at your place. We'll sing graces. Those of you who have been here, help lead the grace. Father, for this noonday meal, we would speak the praise we feel. Health and strength we have from thee.
Dear Mom, today I got up extra early and probably woke a few people up to go clean the stables. I ended up getting there an hour early, but that was my problem. Basically, all you had to do was rake it up and shovel it. It was easy. Then I came back, washed my hands, heard a few complaints about how I woke up everybody, and went to breakfast.
Grab bug juice and go. Take one and go back to your table. Grab a tray, take a bug juice, go back to your table.
The food is like last year. Bad so far. This morning we had cold cereal, and I got into a fight over the Rice Krispies. Later on, they told us that we're having this field day or of some sort or whatever. I'm going to throw the horseshoes for the team. We're supposed to meet at about 10:45.
Okay, all the teams ready. Give me your attention. All right, now listen up or you're going to lose out. On the go. Your team member goes to his station from here. He does what he's supposed to do. Gives the baton to the next person. Smitty, will you put that damn thing down, please, for 2 seconds? Is everything clear to everybody?
Do they wait at the station that they're supposed to be at?
No, can we set the people up at their stations?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay.
Set up at the stations before the one they do, like if they've got to do tennis, they go to the soccer and run from the soccer.
No, they go to the tennis and then the person from soccer runs over.
Runs over and gives them the baton.
So okay. They go whatever they're...
They go to where they're going to
be. And after that we had free swim. Free swim is just exactly what it's called, swimming freely.
Buddy check!
Dear Mom, tonight we're going to have a campfire. We're going to discuss things.
Listen up. At 10 o'clock, there's a rule. Lights are out in all your cabins. 10 o'clock, I don't care if you guys... Listen up. The lights in the cabin, flashlights, everything. That's it. Okay? Everybody goes up to the cabin. You get the guys that are going to take... Everybody takes one shower a day. I don't care who you are, okay? You either take it in the morning or you take it the night before. Everybody go to the bathroom and everything. And then at 10 o'clock, that's it. You guys can... listen up, because this holds for the whole summer. I don't care.
Our counselor Chuck told a ghost story about the H-Man, who I had never heard of, even though I had heard many legends about this camp. We were sort of scared. It was supposed to be this big, hairy blob with a big scar across his chest and eyes that glowed in the dark. I think he used to be a counselor, the meanest counselor there was, and they executed him.
Okay, there used to be, a long time ago, a Boy Scout camp at the other end of the lake. I don't know if you guys have ever been Boy Scouts, but Boy Scouts can get pretty mischievous and everything. And one night, the Boy Scouts went, and they really didn't like this guy, because this guy didn't like the Boy Scouts at all, because the Boy Scouts were loud and everything. So what they did one night was they went to his house, and they had a big, big pot of honey.
Last night, the Laurel Ridge girls memorized all their camp songs, and they are always singing, which is unfortunate to the boys and fortunate to the girls, because the girls sound awful, but the girls love to sing. The boys don't sing because boys don't like singing. Dear Mom, last night after Lights Out, which is at 10 o'clock, Adam, Slapnick, and Ty were all talking about sex. Jeff, Brad, and I just listened.
I'd rather have Miss January. She's mine, all mine. She's in the centerfold. Hey, look, is this the center? Is this the center? What the heck?
Adam, come on.
Dear Mom and Dad, I'll be leaving camp soon. I would like to come back next year for my normal week. Camp is pretty fun, and we're having so much fun that we keep on forgetting if we are getting homesick, which some of us are and some of us aren't. I personally am not, because I've gotten used to going to camp. Next year I'd probably bring some extra food and also bring some Playboy magazines if I could ever steal them from my uncle.
Mike Kelly wrote those letters home 4 years ago. He's 14 now, and he's been going to the same camp for 7 years. He was sent home early this year because he stepped on a rusty nail. He notes that things at camp have changed over the years.
It was better in the earlier years than it has been in the latter years.
And what's wrong now?
Oh, I don't know. They got a little stricter, I guess. It's hard to explain unless you have something to compare it with.
Mm-hmm. Tell me something. Did you ever get your hands on your uncle's Playboy magazines?
I had a feeling this would come up. Not exactly.
Not exactly. What does that mean?
Kind of means I got my own.
You got your own. Michael, I hope you're feeling better and your foot gets better and that you don't have to be with your parents too much, because a kid in the summer ought to have some freedom. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mike Kelly, talking to Nina Totenberg.
And now we feature a very American movie star, Kevin Costner. Here's reporter Alex Chadwick.
Luck is more important in some things than in others. More useful in cards, for instance, than in turning cartwheels. It takes practice and agility to get cartwheels right. But gamblers and gymnasts and probably persons from every other way of life who make good share this, a piece of luck somewhere in the past, a lucky break. Here's one such incident, recalled by an actor who got his break, only to see things turn out not so well, and then to get lucky again.
Larry said after he finished his last movie, he goes, "You see any interesting actors lately?" And Wally said, "Yeah, I did see one actor." And she goes, "Well," he goes, "Well, who was it?" And she said, "It was Kevin Costner." So a year later, he doesn't say anything. He's casting his movie. He goes, "I remember that guy you were telling me about." So he remembers. He remembered. He goes, "Let's bring him in." And so, like, I read from about five times, and finally, I got it.
Kevin Costner is a 30-year-old Californian who is not quite a movie star. His break, his great good luck, came when Larry, Lawrence Kasdan, the screenwriter and director, remembered hearing about him. Kasdan decided to put Costner in a movie that became one of the most popular and successful films of recent years, The Big Chill. But when the shooting was done, Kasdan changed his mind about some of his characters. So Costner's only appearance in the big hit, The Big Chill, was as a corpse. Then, Lawrence Kasdan went on to make a Western, Silverado, with a character that this time he would leave in, the wild, gunslinging younger brother, Jake.
Hey, real quick.
Now Kevin Costner's come to Washington with a movie crew for a new film they're making, a spy thriller, with Costner as a young Navy officer who uncovers a dangerous secret. They're shooting location shots to give the movie a sense of place.
And roll, please. Background, action!
The critical piece of casting was Tom Farrell, which is the role that Kevin Costner's playing.
Laura Ziskin is producing the new movie, Deceit, a movie which she hopes will make Kevin Costner a household name.
I don't want to compare him to anybody because I think he's unique, but he has an almost like old-fashioned movie star quality, kind of boyishness and depth to him, and you don't really know quite what's going on, which keeps him real interesting, a little bit of danger. It's too apparent that he has a special quality, and it's ultimately going to be the matching of his persona with the right material. I hope it's going to happen with this picture. And if not with this one, with something else, because I think he's just got what it takes.
On a hot, clear day, the production crew on a side street in an old section of the city, Costner sits in a tall canvas movie chair, watching videotape of the sequence they've just shot. He's handsome. He looks lanky, but has that look without really being tall. He must be outdoors a lot. His face is browned. He doesn't need to wear makeup for this scene. He's got a kind of open-faced, appealing grin, and when he grins it, you just like him right away and think he looks about as American as a day in Kansas. They shoot this same scene three more times.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we're finished here. That's a print. Let's move off the street. Camera moves to Jefferson Street, back to where our first position was. PCPD.
About 1 in the afternoon, they stop for lunch, and Costner leads us off to his trailer, where we can talk for a while about acting.
I've been at it for 9 years and only been able to make a living at it about the last 3.5.
What did you do the rest of the time?
I stage manage. I went to class, and I started acting groups. And I just I acted all the time. That was the key to it. It was acting. I think enjoying acting is the ultimate thing. I'm not always that even satisfied with the movies or even while I'm doing a movie, but I always get tremendously satisfied if during a rehearsal I do something really well, because I always think, well, maybe you should go on then. You know, it's like a rite of passage, you know, when you find something. So rehearsal, they're just as important to me as anything else. It's just that moment of creating. If it happens, that's really great. A lot of times it can happen. I mean, the scene we're doing today, you know, I'm sitting on concrete and getting up and running away, and I'm essentially running for my life. Well, you know, there's not too much to that. You just get up and run for your life. But, you know, a lot of times when you can find certain things, and I like that, and that's really what sustained me, not so much even in a financial way those 6 years, was hitting marks occasionally as an actor during those 6 years sustained me.
And when you did hit it, you knew it?
Yeah, you always know. It's like a real firm feeling. It's like crossing a stream and you feel a little bolder, and it's boom, boom, boom. You know, you don't want to step there, or I think I can step there. I'm anticipating it to slide a little bit, but I know I can make it. And then occasionally you hit that one rock and you just go, aha, this is a point at which I will pivot everything around.
I've got some notes from the scene that you were just shooting. Mostly what I have written down is waiting. Underlined and underlined.
Yeah.
spend a lot of time waiting for things to happen.
Yeah, you do. And you and that's a that can be a real healthy time too if you learn how to use that. I think the biggest problems I have in acting, and I think maybe other people too, is concentration, because the film is so fragmented. You know, you can get easily caught up, especially when you shoot location, there becomes a crowd and communication's a little bit harder, and you can find yourself walking back and forth talking about things. But you know, in the waiting, it can be very constructive for the actor.
It is a long day. It's a 12-hour day. Your lunch just showed up.
It's usually longer than that, actually. Yeah. For me, it runs about 14 to 15, even 16 hours a day, because I look at the film afterwards.
Every day?
Yeah. So we'll start at 6. We'll probably get done at 7. Maybe take us 20 minutes, 30 minutes, maybe an hour to get back to the hotel. We turn around and go look at film for an hour. And then you have to still go eat dinner. So it can run you into 10 o'clock, and then you turn around and start again.
How many movies do you want to make a year?
Well, I'm learning all that, you know, what I can take physically, what, you know, I can take psychologically, everything else. If they're good, I'll probably be chomping, you know, I'll probably be the dog on the chain, just, you know, trying to get at it if it's a good movie. Because, you know, they only pass you. You know, they're not the end of life, but as they pass you, you have to have that kind of hunger. If I see a really good role, I turn into a gorilla to get it.
There is this last line at the end of the movie Silverado,
mm-hmm.
when you're riding off to California, and you say, "So long, we'll be back." Will Silverado return as a sequel? People talking to you about that?
Well, no one's talking to me about it, but I believe there should be another one, because I believe that movie delivered on every level. I think there should be more of those kind of movies. They're not the only kind of movies, but that's a movie of if I could have the same feeling seeing Silverado every time I went into a movie, not necessarily the up feeling when you walk out, but just that feeling of something happened, something was delivered, I think that the theaters would never stop being filled. So yeah, I kind of vote for it. I think they're actually silly to not make one. I think it would be a $100 million movie.
That was Kevin Costner talking to Alex Chadwick. Special thanks this month go to the hardest working man in show business, Mr. Michael Kasif. Next month, singer Paul Simon talks about his Graceland CD. The Monkees, the singing group The Monkees, holds auditions. And we have an interview with filmmaker Spike Lee. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.